also means that the USA could win the World Cup on this next kick.
It was the sports bra seen round the world right after this happened.
Chastain will take it. She missed a penalty kick against China in the Algarve Cup, and they lost that game.
Who can forget when Brandi Chastain ripped off her jersey and waved it around her head in celebration after hitting the game-winning goal in the 1999 Women's World Cup final against China? Male soccer players take off their shirts to celebrate goals all the time, but Chastain's exuberance became the talk of the nation. Some found it inappropriate. Others had more elaborate theories.
I was amused at the time by the people saying, oh, Nike set that up. I was like, no, I don't think China would have agreed to that. And if Nike had really set that up, I'm sure Brandi Chastain's sports bra would have had a big white swoosh on it.
Eventually, the controversy died down, and Chastain's sports bra became synonymous with women's soccer, a symbol of triumph. But back in 1985, almost 15 years before Chastain and the 99 women's team won the World Cup, the very first U.S. women's national team, well, they had an even bigger issue with their wardrobe.
Let us play, let us play,
let us play,
let us play, let us play,
oh, let us play.
Welcome to The Thread, a podcast where we unravel the stories behind some of the most important lives and events in history to learn more about the surprising connections between them. I'm Sean Braswell. This season's thread started with the 99ers, the U.S. national team whose triumph in the 1999 World Cup launched women's soccer into the stratosphere.
I don't know if anything tops that moment in 1999 still.
Caitlin Murray is a journalist and author of The National Team, the inside story of the women who changed soccer.
For the players who were around, who were kids at the time, they all talk about remembering the 1999 World Cup. They remember that changing the idea of soccer and what they wanted to do when they grew up.
But the 99ers' victory would not have been possible without another group of women, a team who also wore the Team USA uniforms, even if they were a bit baggy. There wasn't a whole lot of need for a U.S. women's national soccer team in the mid-1980s. There was no Women's World Cup, and the sport was not in the Olympics.
Yeah, there had been paper teams of the national team from 1982 to 1984. These were teams where the best players in the country were picked and their names were on a sheet of paper, and that was it. They didn't actually play any games.
All that changed in 1985 at the National Sports Festival in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
An event of the U.S. Olympic Committee, the sports festival is America's centerpiece of amateur athletics. And this summer, it comes to Louisiana.
Women's soccer was featured in this event for the first time, and it was sort of a mini-Olympics that they had on non-Olympic years where athletes from around the country would compete against each other.
Organizers announced a list of players for the women's national team after the tournament concluded.
For the players whose names were read on that list, it took them by surprise. They didn't know anything about it.
After the sports festival happened, they pulled us together and they basically said, you're not only a paper team, but we're also going to go to Italy in 2 weeks, and we're going to go play in this Mundialito, which then was, you know, a mini World Cup.
Stacey Enos was a member of that 1985 national team.
It definitely took us all by surprise, the immediacy of it. I had a chance to go home for a few days after the festival, and then we flew to New York, and we stayed out on Long Island, and we trained for a week or so, and then we all hopped on a plane and flew over to Italy.
The hastily assembled national team had a shoestring budget. They were given uniforms, commonly called kits, but they were not women's soccer uniforms. Journalist Caitlin Murray.
They didn't have names or any information that would make it seem like they were designed for the players who were about to wear them. And for the women who got these kits, they really didn't look like they were designed for the team at all.
And they didn't fit very well.
It was apparent they were men's kits because they did not fit them at all. They were huge. They, you know, came around their ankles. So the night before the team went to Italy, they were up late with their trainers. They had, you know, threads and needles, and they were cutting and sewing their outfits to make sure they actually fit them properly. The players made it work.
Stacey Enos again.
I don't know if we looked the part. Like, I don't know if people recognized that we were a soccer club, but you felt proud to step on it with your teammates and get on the plane and share with people that you were the U.S. women's national team.
The team arrived in Milan, Italy, then took a five-hour bus ride to a small resort town near Venice, where the soccer tournament was to take place. Emily Pickering Harner was also a member of that first national team.
It was a beautiful beach town. The pasta was awesome. The food was great. I mean, the whole thing was incredible. We're on a beach resort. It was vacation.
Bruce Springsteen had just come out with his big album, Born in the USA, and everybody in Italy loved it. So when we walk out on the field, they usually played this song, Born in the USA, which we would kind of look at each other out on the field and just start laughing.
It was the first time that women had represented the U.S. in an official international soccer match, and they were playing against other national teams like Italy, England, and Denmark with much more experience. Stacey Enos.
It was definitely eye-opening. Just brilliant, high-level soccer. We had to fight for every moment and every opportunity in a match. And it was definitely harder than anyone could have ever anticipated.
The Americans also dealt with more than the tough competition on the field. Just getting to the field was a challenge before their match against England. Emily Pickering Harner.
Our bus got lost. We were traveling and driving in the bus for an hour. And we barely got there in time for game time. I think we were flat going into it. And boom, they scored. Boom, they scored. And boom, they scored.
The team lost to England and would go on to lose three games and draw one at the tournament. Journalist Caitlin Murray.
The U.S. looked like they were playing in their first ever games. And that's how the results went. The U.S. did not look prepared for facing the teams that they met at this tournament in Italy.
But the U.S. team did win over many of the local Italian fans who attended. Stacey Enos.
We always thought they were booing us because they were going, USA, USA. And so eventually when we stopped to look at the fans and they want your autographs and they were cheering you, they were all saying, USA for USA.
Going to Italy was a formative experience for the young team.
I felt like we had a strong presence, and we made ourselves known, and we learned a lot. It was invaluable. Then we kind of knew the landscape, we knew our competition, and we knew what we had to do.
For the moment, there was no prospect of going to a World Cup or to the Olympics. It was just the beginning of a journey. This group of pioneers was just learning how to play together and overcome adversity. It was the start of a team culture that would endure countless challenges in the upcoming years and eventually conquer the world. If there was no glamour in U.S. women's soccer in the 1980s, there was also certainly no money. Again, Caitlin Murray.
The players on the early national teams were not doing it to be famous or get rich or be on TV because those things weren't even possibilities yet. The players were getting $10 per diem when they played in the U.S. They got $15 when they traveled abroad.
And the first national teams received little attention from either the public or the press.
You know, we look at where the team is today, the endorsement deals they get, the salaries that they make. That was not even, I think, a remote possibility in the players' minds at the time. It was purely for the love of the game, purely to represent the country.
The lack of compensation and resources only further motivated the players. Tim Nash is the author of It's Not the Glory and has covered the women's national team for decades.
What really helped the team develop and become what they are is the attitude that, well, we're not getting any money, so how do we go out and win? So they would do whatever they could. They would get very creative.
Take, for instance, midfielder Michelle Akers, one of the team's best players. She sometimes worked out on racquetball courts.
She didn't need anybody to pass the ball to or shoot at when she had four walls around her. So she'd just go in there and bash them off the wall and work on striking the ball, work on receiving the ball all at once.
The players were largely responsible for maintaining their own fitness during the long periods of time in which there were no games. Stacey Enos.
I had already graduated, so I needed to jump in any scrimmage game or any pickup game I could find. I used the weight room a lot and just ran on my own. So it was a lot of just self-discipline, basically.
The discipline extended into all parts of their lives, including what jobs the players could take. Caitlin Murray.
And you have a player like Karen Jennings. She was the best player on the team at the time. She also was working in a marketing job, and she had to keep quitting her job so she could keep playing soccer, because she would go to her employer and say, hey, can I have a couple weeks off to go to camp with the national team and train? And of course, the employer was like, no, you can't just keep leaving your job to go play soccer. So she would quit the job that she had, compete with the national team, and then have to get a new job. And she did that multiple times to the point where it was a running joke within the team. Like, oh, Karen quit another job today.
And there was certainly no career to be had in playing soccer.
So it wasn't like you're paying dividends towards something that's going to materialize.
Lauren Gregg was the assistant coach of the 99ers that we heard from in episode one. She was also a player on the early women's national teams.
There was no promise of anything more than what was right in front of you, which was very little from the outside. But for those of us in it, it was everything.
Gregg slept on the floor of someone else's apartment, so she didn't have to pay rent.
It was very difficult to have, you know, a full-time job and train at the level you needed to and then be able to up and leave for, you know, a couple of weeks at a time. And people weren't so forgiving as they are now because it's so popular now. Back then, it was like we were doing all this in an abyss.
Early on, the team only played about 5 to 8 games a year. When they traveled for tournaments, their trip expenses were paid. But it was not exactly luxury travel.
The players tease today about wanting to have, you know, like jet service, you know, and not fly commercial. And we're like, are you kidding me? Like back then it was like from row 30 back was smoking and, you know, 29 above was non-smoking. And so obviously the entire plane was, you know, a smoking plane or, you know, so we'd just literally be like covering ourselves in blankets.
The team rode on low-flying propeller planes in China. They played on dirt fields in Sardinia. Tim Nash.
They rode on a coal train through Bulgaria. Their faces were just black with coal soot. The restroom was a hole in the floor.
At one hotel they stayed in Haiti, they got 1 hour each day of running water and electricity.
So they would be jumping in and out of shower trying to get, and then the ones who couldn't do that just bathed in the pool, and they said it was pretty nasty by the time they left.
But in such environments, the team really had time to get to know one another. They did not complain about how they were treated. They just worked harder. Again, Lauren Gregg.
We never felt deprived and felt very lucky to have the opportunity. And we grew tremendously from that. And that foundation of training when no one's watching became sort of the foundation for the success, I think, of the team over the next decade.
The drive and the resilience of this group of women would shape a national team that has won gold medals in 4 Olympics and 3 World Cup championships in 1991, 1999, and 2015. Here's how 3 national team players express what those early days meant to them.
You look back and you think, to me, it was some of the happiest days of my life.
Still to this day, cry at the national anthem because I was the best of the best of the best. You know, it's a cool feeling.
There's also just a great sense of pride that knowing that we were one of the foundations and one of the building blocks, we're the start of the history of the women's national team. I'm proud to be on the 85 team. It opened doors, and I carry it with a full heart.
It was no accident that the 1985 team players got the chance to be pioneers in women's soccer. They were part of a generation of women that played on the front lines of history, thanks to a controversial new law. That's up next. Things really started to change for women's sports in 1972. That's when Title IX, a law banning sex discrimination in federally funded education programs, was passed by Congress and signed into law by President Richard Nixon. Nixon signed the bill on June 23, 1972. It did not get a lot of attention. 6 days earlier, something even more momentous happened in the news.
Good evening. We have a mystery story out of Washington. Five people have been arrested and charged with breaking into the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee in the middle of the night.
The Democratic National Committee is located in the Watergate office building.
For the next 2 years, while President Nixon and the American public were distracted by the Watergate scandal, Title IX was slowly remaking the sports landscape. The law meant that young women everywhere, at least in theory, had access to competitive sports. Sports programs for girls exploded in the decades that followed. In 1974, for example, there were only about 100,000 girls across the country that were registered with the U.S. Youth Soccer Association. Now that number is in the millions. The women of those first national soccer teams were among the earliest beneficiaries of Title IX. Karen Blumenthal is a journalist and author of Let Me Play, the story of Title IX, the law that changed the future of girls in America.
The women athletes of the 1970s were sometimes called Title IX babies. For girls born in the 1970s, the opportunities were vastly different than for girls born before that. There were sports teams from an early age. And so there were soccer leagues and soccer teams for three-year-old girls, just like there were for three-year-old boys. There were gymnastics opportunities for younger kids. There were volleyball teams in elementary school.
National team player Emily Pickering Harner again.
As a girl growing up in the 70s, 60s and 70s, I was involved in all kinds of sports and wanted to play them all. And as soon as I was allowed to play Little League Baseball, due to Title IX, I played Little League Baseball. And so Title IX was big and huge for me. I knew about it at a very early age.
But it was still hard to be a female athlete.
In my high school, we did not have girls' soccer. Three of us decided to try out for the boys' team. Well, they put an obstacle in our way that we were required to run, do sit-ups, do push-ups, and things like that. Suffice it to say, none of us being prepared for it passed the test, so we didn't get to play on the boys' team.
Stacy Enos had a similar experience.
Sophomore year of high school, we finally got a girls' soccer team. There was a point where my family had considered moving, or I was maybe going to go live with an aunt and uncle just in order to play high school soccer.
Even with Title IX in effect, it took many colleges even longer to get with the program. Soccer analyst Jen Cooper.
We all know Title IX passed in 1972, but it's not like a light switch was flipped on and suddenly everybody's playing collegiate sports. You know, it took a while for conferences to get organized, schools to get organized, facilities, recruiting, all that stuff. It's like slowly taking hold.
If U.S. colleges wanted to offer scholarships to male athletes, they had to offer them to women now as well. Susan Ware is a historian and author of Game, Set, Match, Billie Jean King, and the Revolution in Women's Sports.
And then as more and more women are getting these athletic scholarships, it increases the talent pool. It increases the depth and skill of the teams that they're being recruited on. And then you really see that playing out over the next couple of decades. So you begin to see how these scholarships are so important in the athletic training of our future heroes.
And those heroes include the women who played on the first national soccer teams. Caitlin Murray.
The national team was kind of built on Title IX because so many of those players who went on to have long, important careers with the national team were identified in college as college players. So you have to think, if there's no Title IX, if none of these women are competing in college, who is going to be on the national team?
Some of these women found themselves repeatedly at ground zero for a changing sports world. Stacy Enos.
I consider myself a pioneer by all standards. I mean, I've definitely have been on a lot of firsts. You know, I've been on my first high school team. I'm the college's first NCAA team, and then also had the opportunity to be on the first U.S. women's national team.
The women on that first national team were true pioneers. But there was another, earlier team that really moved things forward, one in an entirely different sport. A group of women who were not just pioneers, they were revolutionaries. They were members of the Yale women's crew team.
They'd get on an unheated bus. They'd drive 30 minutes to the Housatonic. They'd compete and they'd train in the wind and the rain and the snow. And then they had to wait on an unheated bus while every last Yale member of the men's rowing team would shower.
I mean, we're at Yale University. We are incredibly bright women. And if we were to say it's okay for us to be treated this way, what kind of message would that be for us to send out into the universe?
And so the women decided to make a statement.
We needed to speak our truth, and we wanted our voice to be heard. And I can imagine that in other athletic departments, athletic directors all of a sudden said, oh my God, did you hear what those women at Yale did? And maybe they started to think, could that happen here?
In the next episode of The Thread, the story of the Yale 19, a group of women who paved the way for the women's national soccer teams and whose bold act of defiance sent shockwaves through college campuses across the nation and changed what it meant to be a female athlete in America. The Thread is produced by Robert Kulos, Shannon Williamson, and me, Sean Braswell. Evan Roberts engineered our show. This episode features the song Let Us Play, written and performed by Teacup Gin. You can hear more of their songs at teacupgin.com. To learn more about The Thread, visit aussie.com/thethread, all one word, and make sure to subscribe to The Thread on Apple Podcasts, follow us on iHeartRadio, or listen wherever you get your podcasts.